We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/lawless. Just go to Indeed.com/lawless right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/lawless. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
No more important game and no more important win in American soccer history when it comes to the men's team. Hello, Sunshine. I'm Alexi Lawless and welcome to the State of the Union podcast, where we look at the beautiful game on and off the field through the lens of red, white, and blue colored glasses. This show will be talking podcast people, the U.S. Women's National Team roster drop, stutter step, anonymous executives, referee deal, Olympic team, final Euro spots, MLS restructuring, the Matrix, top five USA goals versus Mexico, and so much more. But first, joining me as always, my friend, my colleague, my guiding light, David Mossy, a soccer savant and a Fox soccer researcher and writer extraordinaire. Mossy, how you doing on this Wednesday, March 27th in the year 2024?
I'm doing okay. I do feel like a little bit of a loser after you and I came away empty-handed last night.
Yes. Last night, we attended the AMBY Awards. I think I got that right. In downtown LA, we had mentioned a few weeks ago that we were fortunate enough to be nominated for one of these awards that recognizes excellence in podcasting. We were up against a formidable group of nominees, including one of your idols over there with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who ultimately ended up winning. And while we lost, my mom was quick to point out when I informed her of our loss that in her eyes, we are all winners. And I was not able to give the acceptance speech there, but had I been able to, I would have thanked everybody that makes us look good, Mossy, each and every time we step on this set. And the men and women behind the scenes that, like I said, it takes a village. But we had a good night out anyway with Sean Sullivan and Aaron Schechter, who joined us at the event. And it was fun, but it was a little interesting to see a gathering of all podcast people. They are a special breed.
How good did Sean and Aaron look? They clean up nice, huh?
So nice. And it was wonderful to spend some time with them. And we had some drinks and some laughs. And then immediately when we lost, we stormed out en masse and went and had some food.
We were like the Pistons against the Bulls in 91. Exactly. We didn't stick around until the end. Now that JW Marriott, where the event took place, that's a great hotel. I ought to know. I went there twice in the last 12 hours.
All right. So you have to tell the folks this story. We're going to go a little bit long in this opening segment. So if you want to, you know, speed ahead, go ahead. But you're going to miss a quintessential Mossy story here. Yeah. So tell the folks what happened.
Yeah. Sean Sullivan bailed on us early. Aaron Schechter hung around until what she thought was the end of the night. But little does she know, there was a whole nother chapter to the evening, because after she dropped us off back here at Pico, I realized I didn't have my car keys with me. And so we went back to the stalking horse to look for it. It wasn't there. And we called the JW Marriott. They had it. It was in the lost and found there. So yes, we got home taking Ubers. And then this morning I had to go back to the hotel to get my car keys.
My favorite part was, so Aaron dropped us off in the underground parking garage here at Fox so that you could get your car. And I was going to get my bag out of your car that I had left there. And as she dropped us off and we got out of her car and started walking towards your car, you looked at me with that sheepish look and I knew something was up. And he goes, "You're never going to believe this." and you proceeded to tell me what was going on, but you made it very, very clear that I was in no way to, in body movement or anything that I said, let Erin know that this had happened.
The one thing I did not want to happen is for her to offer to drive me around to look for it, which she would have done because she's the nicest person in the world. But at that point, I wanted her to be free to go home and move on with her life.
And so we were like, just keep walking. Just keep walking and keep walking.
Let her go. Let her go. We'll sort this out ourselves, which we did.
Oh my goodness.
You know, I told you this when I went to the JW Marriott this morning. I caught the March Madness crowd because there's a regional at Crypto Arena across the street, Sweet 16 and Elite Eight, and the crowd had arrived for that. So it was a zoo in that lobby with college basketball fans all dressed up and excited about their schools.
Well, like my mom said, we're all winners anyway. Have you watched anything, my friend?
Not really. All I've got is last night.
Okay. So I also have nothing, but I'm throwing this out there. I was driving into work and some people were talking about The Matrix. You know this movie, The Matrix?
I do.
It seems to be seminal. It seems to be a cultural touchstone for a generation. If you can believe this, I have never watched The Matrix. And there are a couple of Matrixes, I think, maybe more than that, that have come out after it. But I have never watched this movie. And so driving into work today, I said, you know what? I'm going to find a way this weekend or some point this next couple of days to watch The Matrix. And I will give you my my verdict on how good or bad this is. But it never goes away. And people constantly are referencing and talking about it. And not even necessarily as the movie. As almost a premonition type of story in the way that it talks about the future and all that kind of stuff. At least that's what I hear. So I am going to watch The Matrix and I will give you my review next week. Have you seen The Matrix?
I actually have not.
Oh, for God's
sake. That's one of the big holes in my movie
resume.
Well,
we can both, let's both watch The Matrix. I know there's people right now that are listening to this in their car or they're walking or something. How is it possible that these two morons have not seen The Matrix? But I have not seen The Matrix, so I will watch it.
So that's my homework assignment for our next
podcast. There we go. That is your homework assignment. All right. Shall we light this candle?
Let's do it.
Where shall we start, Mossy?
We begin with the U.S. women's national team. After winning the Gold Cup, their next order of business is the She Believes Cup, which is set up like a Final Four this year. The U.S. will play Japan April 6th in Atlanta, and then either Canada or Brazil April 9th in Columbus. These will be the final matches under Twyla Kilgore before Emma Hayes takes over in June, and Twyla Kilgore named a 23-player roster for these games. The headline: both Katarina Macario and Mallory Swanson are back after lengthy injury absences. Swanson hasn't played for the U.S. since April of 23, Macario not since April of 22. And they are part of a loaded attack that includes Alex Morgan, Sophia Smith, Jaden Shaw, and Trinity Rodman.
Yeah, there are a couple of standards, if you will, in the form of, you know, Crystal Dunn, Alyssa Nair. But I'm excited about this. I'm excited about whether it's names that we were denied because of injury, when you're talking about Mal Swanson and Katarina Macario, whether it's young players, this is, I think, a much more of a turning of the page, and I hope that it pays off. What do you think? How do you think it goes with Emma Hayes now from afar? Do you think that Twyla and Emma get on the phone ahead of time and go through this? I mean, this is, while it's under Twyla, this is Emma, right?
I think so, yeah. And there are two interesting newcomers that speak to that. This 21-year-old PSG defender, Eva Gattino, and 16-year-old Ajax midfielder, Lily Johannes. She's somebody who was born in the U.S., moved to the Netherlands at the age of 10. There's been a question as to which country she was going to play for. And keep in mind, Ajax just faced Chelsea in a Champions League quarterfinal first leg. So Emma Hayes got an up-close look at her, and here she is on this list. So I think that one is definitely Emma.
Keep them coming. We talked about Jenna Neiswanger and this new generation that has grown up watching this team and now wants their chance. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. I'm excited about these games and then obviously how this relates to what's going to happen with the Olympic team going forward and what that's going to look like right now. So good things in terms of the players that are back from injury and some of the, like we said, some of the young players. Some bad news, though, when it comes to Midge Purse.
Yes, she has torn her ACL, so she obviously is not on this roster and will be out a long time. This continues to be an issue in the women's game. There are so many injuries like this, and Midge Purse, the latest victim.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, hopefully she comes back and her, you know, her injury keeps her out for as little as possible. But that's just another gut punch for a good player that we wanted to see. Where should we go now?
We transition to the U.S. men. Before we get to the Olympic team, any lingering thoughts on the senior team, Jamaica, Mexico, Greg Berhalter, and all the rest?
Yeah, so, you know, as we get further and further away, it's kind of like politics in that while we make big deals about these things, it's also, you know, a mountain out of a molehill in that I don't think a lot of people have changed their mind one way or another. It goes back to what you said, which was so smart about people made their mind up about Greg Berhalter a long time ago. When it comes to this team, I do think that coming out of this window, there is an increase and an uptick in optimism about what can be. That doesn't mean that it's not... that there's not plenty of pessimism and cynicism and anger as to whether what we have seen is going to continue under Greg Berhalter. But, you know, I think that one good thing to come out of this is a general consensus that the United States is not only advanced and far advanced when it comes to Mexico, but that for us to fulfill this prophecy, or whatever you want to call it, from this generation of doing things the likes of which we haven't seen before. It is good to celebrate when we win, but with perspective and understand that this team, we expect to do well against the elites. And until we actually see them on a consistent basis coming up against the elites, many people, I think, are still going to reserve judgment. And that's fair.
I've mentioned this before. FoxSoccer.com has an incredible 1-2 punch right now. Both Doug McIntyre and Lakin Littman wrote excellent pieces after this Nations League Final Four, so everybody should check those out. I feel there's like a little bit of a messy Ronaldo rivalry between those two. They try to one-up each other, so that's an interesting subplot as well.
Doug also just came out with his interview with Christian Pulisic. I know we'll talk a little bit about him later on. So that was interesting, some of the things in terms of his wonderful moment right now. All right, should we go to the baby Nats, if you will?
Yes, the U.S. Olympic team played two friendlies during this window. First, they beat Guinea 3-0. Gianluca Buzio among the scorers there. Guinea could end up in the U.S.'s group. And then the U.S. faced France, who we know definitely will be in the U.S.'s group. Outplayed most of the match, down 2-0 late. But then Griffin Yao and Cade Cowles scored 2-2 the final.
Yeah, I mean, this is a perfect example of substitutes coming in and doing what you want. And if you had watched the game before the substitutes and before this final third of the game, I don't think that you would have felt that there was anything in the offing when it comes to a comeback from this Olympic team. They're not as good as France, and they're going to have one hell of a day in the Olympics to find something out of that game against France. France is stacked both at the senior level and certainly here for Thierry Henry at the Olympic level, and they will be one of the favorites going into the Olympic tournament. But it was wonderful to see that confidence and that fight back of this team and to kind of put that on the table leading into the Olympics.
Some other international action. The field is set for Euro 2024. We had the last three playoff finals on Tuesday. Georgia beat Greece on penalties after a 0-0 draw in Tbilisi. They are off to their first ever major tournament. Ukraine came from behind to beat Iceland 2-1 in a match played in Poland. Mudryk with a late winner there. And then Poland beat Wales on penalties after a 0-0 draw in Cardiff. Chesney denying Daniel James in that shootout. That's the game we covered on FS1, but we had our eye on all of them.
Yeah.
Go wherever you want.
All right, so the Georgia-Greece game. So first off, as much as it hurts me to say it, congratulations to Georgia. They become the only team in this summer's Euros that are debutants. So congratulations on going for the first time. You know, Greece has a history when it comes to the Euros. This is a difficult and disappointing way to go out. Yakoumakis missed not only his penalty, but missed the entire goal. He came on as a substitute, but the scenes were just wonderful. And you see how much it means to not just the fans of the game, but to the country, to represent that country on this type of stage. So that was wonderful. The Ukraine comeback against Iceland gives us and sets up a wonderful storyline for this summer, given what Ukraine has been through as a country. And, you know, they will be a kind of sentimental favorite given the situation there. And, you know, that was fun to see. The Wales-Poland game, you know, it remains to be seen. I'd ask you, who would you rather have in the tournament, Wales or Poland? Or is it just six and one, half a dozen, the other?
Six and one, half a dozen, whatever they're saying.
Yeah, but that's my point. You know, the way we saw Wales in the World Cup, in the Men's World Cup, and, you know, while they were, you know, the story was fun, they don't add or take anything away from the tournament going. And the same thing with Poland. Maybe Poland gets the slight edge because of Lewandowski in this twilight type of period. And this goes back to, you know, storylines. I mentioned Ukraine, and, you know, you could add Germany. And we talked about that on the previous pod on Germany as host. That's going to be a big thing. Also, players in the twilight of their career, not just players, but legends in the twilight of their career, getting maybe one last go. When you look at Cristiano Ronaldo, when you look at Luka Modric, when you look at here, Robin Lewandowski, for an opportunity. I know producer Sean was a little miffed at the penalty when it came to Robert Lewandowski.
Yeah, I mean, we've had this discussion before. You're not supposed to be able to come to a complete stop. And Sean feels like they're way too lax with that. If they're going to be sticklers about goalkeepers staying on the line for penalties, they got to uphold that part of the rule too, because you're allowed to do a little stutter step, but Sean feels like Lewandowski came to a complete stop here. What do you think?
Well, I think you're not allowed to come to a complete stop in the kicking of the ball, okay? So, if you're watching it here, you can see it was like a bunny hop and a horse jump and up and down. And producer Sean thinks that this is beyond the pale, and that this is, I don't care. If you want to do a pirouette and a splits and then kiss yourself or do whatever the hell it is, go for it. And then put the ball in the back of the net.
Yeah, Pele's penalty kick style involved doing this little stutter step that was called the paradinha in Brazil. And it's a style that other players have tried to emulate over the years. But yeah, some of them don't get it quite right. The way Pele did it, he never actually came to a full stop in his motion of kicking the ball. So I actually think Sean has a point there. That was a questionable.
You're going to tell somebody how to approach, or what real running is or what real running isn't? No, do whatever you want. I don't care. What if somebody turned around in a circle? Would that be a problem for you?
Turn around in a circle?
Yeah, turned around in a circle and then kicked the ball.
I guess no. That wouldn't be an issue. No.
Well, why? But the bunny jump from Lewandowski is a problem for you?
Yes. So Georgia slot into Group F alongside Turkey, Portugal, and Czechia. Ukraine slot into Group E alongside Belgium, Slovakia, and Romania. And Poland slot into Group D alongside the Netherlands, Austria, and France. The field is set. We have our 24 teams.
Hey, speaking of Germany, by the way, pretty good window for Germany, huh?
Yes. So a few thoughts on the international window as a whole. Germany followed up that win over France by beating the Netherlands 2-1. Füllkrug with a late winner, assisted by Toni Kroos, who had a tremendous return to international play. A lot of people coming around to your view that beware of Germany this summer.
Yeah. So, you know, when we're going through those storylines, you know, Germany now kind of revitalized. And I know it's just one window and a couple of games, and they still will have their problems. But, you know, they can certainly harness a summer in Germany where everybody's going to be the focus. And so it wouldn't surprise me in the least going forward. You know, and things changed rapidly. I mean, look at your Brazil team.
Yeah, so we'll go there next. Spain, Brazil played to a 3-3 draw at the Bernabeu. A couple of teenagers leaving their mark in this match. 17-year-old Endrick for Brazil, days after scoring the winner at Wembley against England, scored here in what will be his future home. He's joining Real Madrid this summer. While 16-year-old Lamine Yamal was the best player on the field, had a sensational match. So we got a sneak peek at the future here. Two players that are likely going to be big stars in the coming years.
So we're still, you know, some days off, but it's coming quick in terms of the summer and this incredible summer, another incredible summer of soccer that we have morning to night when it comes to Euros and into Copa America. As we sit here today, Mossy, give me your top three for favorites when it comes to Copa America, and give me your top three favorites when it comes to the Euros.
France, England, Germany for...
In that order, France, England, Germany. Okay.
And then Argentina. And then either Brazil or Uruguay, two or three. I'd have to think about it.
Colombia, nowhere in there, right?
That's where I was going to go next, actually. Okay. Colombia had a great window. They knocked off both Spain and Romania. Now, Spain played their B team. They rested their starters for Brazil. But nevertheless, Colombia have won their last six games. They're unbeaten in their last 21. They haven't lost in more than 2 years. And that is the U.S.'s next opponent, friendly June 8th at FedEx Field, and a possible U.S. opponent in the knockout stage. So you're right.
But you're not putting them above Uruguay.
You could make a case for putting them up there. You're right. Right now, I guess I have them sort of tied with the U.S. at fourth.
Hey, look, given what we've talked about, the more good elite teams that are potentially opposition for the U.S., the better off we are.
Amazingly enough, James Rodriguez wallowing on the bench at São Paulo, but still playing great for Colombia. Obviously, you've got Luis Diaz, so they've got a little something going on right now.
James is a little bit different, but this last go around for some of these guys, and you know, you talk about Messi and as I mentioned, Cristiano and Modric and all these guys, it's going to be fun, but it'll be interesting to see if this is the last go around and how many actually want to push it to 26 of those guys that we are talking about. But the renaissance of James, remember James, man, oh man, is there anybody that has parlayed a great World Cup into more opportunity than him besides this guy? I don't know.
This summer will be the 10-year anniversary, 2014 World Cup in Brazil, when he won the Golden Boot. I was there at the Maracanã, round of 16 against Uruguay, when he scored two goals, including that volley that was the goal of the tournament. Judy Boyd was also in attendance that day.
That's right. This summer is the 30th anniversary of the 94 World Cup, too. I haven't heard anything about that. I don't even know if we're doing anything. Get the guys together, have some drinks or something like that? I don't know. All right, whatever. Anything, Mossy? Anything before we take a break here?
That is it.
Okay, let's take a break, like I said. And when we come back, we got some EPL action coming up this weekend and some Serie A and some MLS and all sorts of stuff. Don't worry. Okay, welcome back. All right, Mossy, we got some good stuff coming up this weekend. What do we want to focus on here?
Yeah, we transition back to club play, and we have a massive game in the Premier League on Sunday. Manchester City will host Arsenal. Right now, Arsenal and Liverpool level on points atop the table. Arsenal ahead on goal difference, and City 1 point behind those two.
And what happened over the break? Are we losing any players for these teams?
Both Kyle Walker and John Stones came out of games for England, but it doesn't sound like the injuries are serious, so I haven't seen whether they'll be available or not. Arsenal did beat City at the Emirates earlier this season, 1-0 on a goal by Gabriel Martinelli. Interesting note, I asked our boss, Zach Kenworthy, a big Liverpool fan, would you rather this game end in a draw or Arsenal win? And he said Arsenal win, which speaks to the fact that he doesn't respect Arsenal that much. If he feared both these teams, then he'd want a draw so they both drop points. But all he's worried about is City, so he wants them to drop as many points as possible.
Oh, interesting. All right, well, I think Man City's going to beat Arsenal this weekend.
Should be a good one.
All right.
Pep against Arteta. Liverpool, by the way, home to Brighton this weekend. That game is early on Sunday, and then they'll sit back and watch City Arsenal and see what happens there. We go to Italy, where the Americans have some tough games this weekend. AC Milan away to Fiorentina. Remember, Pulisic scored in last four games entering the international break. Didn't score for the U.S., but had a good window. Yeah. And so we'll see if he can keep it going, Musa as well, as they face Fiorentina and Florence.
Yeah, it was interesting reading Dougie Mack's interview with Christian and the way that Doug had asked him, you know, are you doing anything differently? You know, what's the secret sauce right now? And maybe it's just a pasta sauce or something like that, because he couldn't put his finger on anything other than to say that the frenetic pace, not even necessarily on the field, of being in London and juxtaposing that with kind of a much more laid back, relaxed type of environment that he has found in Italy obviously suits him. And I think he attributes that to why he's playing. And he also mentioned something that it is difficult coming in and out as a substitute from a physical perspective. And you become, if you're playing game in and game out, which he is, and you're not getting injured, again, knock on wood, your body acclimates and is ready for it in a strange way. It's kind of counterintuitive because you're actually playing more. But I think he's happy where he is, and it makes us all happy in terms of how well he is playing and how important he has been for AC Milan.
I love Milan as a city, so I'm jealous of him. That center with the Duomo, the Galleria Vittorio Emanuele, the Sforza Castle, the Scala, the great theater. I wonder if Pulisic has taken in any shows there.
Yeah, I mean, in the hierarchy of cities, though, I wouldn't put necessarily Milan over there. I mean, it's a little bit, you know, in terms of you're a history buff and all that kind of stuff, but it's still a fun city.
Yeah, certainly not Florence yes. when it comes to the history.
Well, what is?
Sean Sullivan will visit Florence soon. We were discussing that last night over dinner.
Yes, he has said, even though this is, I think, his second or third time going back to Italy, he is bypassing Venice, an interesting choice there. But I can understand it, and I can get behind that. You know, Venice is great, but there's plenty of other places, too.
Juventus are away to Lazio. We'll see what McKennie, Way, and company can do there. Interesting news on McKennie. He's trying to negotiate a new contract with Juventus, and they might be lowballing him. He's not happy. And so all of a sudden, in what's been a feel-good season for him, there's some friction now.
Pay the man. I mean, all right. Well, if they think they can do better, go for it. But I think, listen, don't, McKennie is going to be just fine. Because if Juventus doesn't want to pay him, then somebody else will pay him handsomely in terms of how valuable he is and how many positions he can play. But I think that this is just posturing ultimately. And, you know, if I was Juventus, I would look at this, you know, bird in hand that they have that is Weston McKennie.
Juve really struggling, by the way. Milan are now in second. Juve have dropped to third in recent weeks. We'll see if they can get back on track. A couple of other big derbies to keep an eye on this weekend. Their Klassiker in Germany, Bayern will host Dortmund.
Yes.
Bayern 10 points back of Leverkusen with 8 rounds remaining, so it's probably all over there. And then we do have Le Classique, Marseille hosting PSG in France. Next up, we transition to Major League Soccer, where we have some big news. The refereeing lockout is over. They've come to an agreement with MLS on a new collective bargaining agreement until 2031. So we will have the regular officials back on the field this upcoming weekend.
And 2031, so this is a long-term deal. And I think they recognized that if they were going to come to some sort of agreement, they didn't want to have to deal with this for a long time. So this is good. This is good. I hope that the referees feel that they, you know, that their time away benefited them in terms of the deal that they ultimately signed. I hope that they are happy with this deal. Usually when deals are signed, nobody's happy, which means that it was a fair type of deal. I don't think that MLS has been hurt in any way by this, you know, this last month of what has happened. And now this weekend, by all accounts, we are going to see I guess we'll call them the real refs back. So there should be no problems, mistakes, disagreement, criticism, controversy, right? Because they're the real refs that are back on the field.
Do I detect a little bit of sarcasm in your voice?
Oh my goodness. How dare you, Mossy? How dare you? All right. Well done. Congratulations. I'm glad that we were able to get past that and we can go on and scream and yell at real refs now.
One other bit of news. We talked on our last pod about the possibility of Olivier Giroud going to LAFC. According to both Tom Bogert and Fabrizio Romano, that is a done deal. He is coming. So LAFC this summer will add France's all-time leading scorer, who scored in this window for them. He's still doing it for France.
Greatest hair in the business, too. He's bringing his hair and his ability to score goals to Los Angeles. This is great. I'm here for it. I'm excited about it. I think he will score goals. Like you mentioned, he's still scoring goals. This is a big signing, but I think this is a smart signing. I don't think that this is going to be looked at as this is over the hill and this is a retirement type of league here for LAFC.
On the field this upcoming weekend, Inter Miami will host NYCFC. Inter Miami, remember, got drilled by the Red Bulls last weekend, so they'll want to bounce back from that. But they also have one eye on their CONCACAF Champions Cup quarterfinal first leg against Monterrey on Wednesday. So we'll see how they play it. We'll see about Messi, who's been injured.
Do you think Messi plays? At some point, he has to come back and play some soccer, right?
But if they're prioritizing CONCACAF Champions Cup, you think you wait to get him fully healthy for that game.
Yeah, and this is a home game. This is against an NYCFC team that's not that good. So maybe you say, yeah, we can still keep him out. But, you know, if I'm a Inter Miami fan that paid for a season ticket and paid those prices specifically because they were selling and marketing Messi in a home game, it's one thing if it's an away game, but a home game, I don't know. I don't know how excited I'd be about that.
And then the LA Galaxy hosts Seattle. The Galaxy second in the West. Seattle all the way at the bottom. 0 wins in 4 games.
Yeah, this is a surprise, but it also is another example of how I think that Major League Soccer is the most difficult league in the world to predict. If I find the man or woman that correctly and consistently can predict what happens in MLS, I will take that person immediately to Las Vegas or anywhere closer, and we will make an awful lot of money. And even some very, very smart people at the beginning of the season picked Seattle as the elite when it came to the West, and it's not working out so far, but there's still lots and lots of ups and downs and twists and turns to go in this season.
Interesting note on the Galaxy, Paul Tenorio conducted a survey of MLS execs who answered anonymously, variety of different subjects. One of them was best offseason signing in the league. Joseph Paintsill was number one.
Really? Well, they got that one right. He has been a wonderful signing so far.
A few other interesting ones. Inter Miami, far and away the favorites to win MLS Cup, but Columbus, far and away the favorites to win the Supporters Shield.
Really? So they think that Miami is just going to lay low multiple fronts. Well, Columbus is fighting on multiple fronts too, though. I think that's actually a smart way of looking at it, because I can certainly see a team like Inter Miami getting hot, and we've seen it before, as opposed to a Columbus that's kind of built for the long term type of thing.
There was one question phrased, Inter Miami's roster build, good or bad for MLS? 18 answered good, just 4 answered bad. The rest were in the middle.
I wonder what the rationale was for those that mentioned bad, in that anything that Miami is doing doesn't mean that you can't do it unless your owner is not going to allow you to do it.
There was one comment about the retirement league stuff and signing all these old players. I think some people think their MLS is being too lenient when it comes to the rules, but others said that this is going to spur on MLS to loosen restrictions. They're going to see how great it is to allow teams to get creative and spend.
You mentioned Pansel before the season being predicted as the best move. Emil Forsberg was number two, and you know he's been okay. By the way, did you see the story about Emil Forsberg and his wife?
Ignoring his family. Jesus Christ.
What a mess. What a mess.
At last one, there was a question, should MLS teams fully participate in the U.S. Open Cup? 20 said yes, only 7 said no.
Yeah, well, this is, okay, that's fine. But we all know that MLS is structured relative to the collective. And if that was the desire, that's great. They can make their voice heard, but ultimately ownership is going to get together. And just because the workforce or the employees believe that something is good doesn't necessarily make it good, let alone mean that the leadership, owners, decision makers are going to say that that's what they are going to do.
That is it.
All right, let's take another quick break. And when we come back, ooh, it's time for Ask Alexi. Don't go anywhere. Okay, welcome back. It's time for Ask Alexi, that part of the show where you send in your comments, questions, or concerns. And you can use those. You can use the hashtag Ask Alexi. And keep in mind that our handle out there on social media is SOTU with Alexi. Or you can call into our State of the Union podcast hotline, which is 657-549-2297. That's 657-549-2297. Mossy, what do the folks want to know today?
First up, at Sportsbook Tom asks, a couple of players, except Keller and Friedel, from your era that would be in the starting 11 today. Just to give a little context here, after the U.S.'s latest win over Mexico, our good friend Eric Winalda made a comment that some of the excitement needs to be tempered because this is the worst Mexico team ever. And it spawned this whole argument on X about how this Mexico team compares to the one that Eric and yourself faced in the 90s. And it's now blossomed into a whole larger debate about comparing players from this era to that era. So I don't know if this question is related to that anyway, but that discussion is in the air right now, thanks to our good friend Eric Winalda.
So first off, I love the fact that we are at a point in American soccer where we can have this discussion, where we have multi-generations now, I'm not going to say fighting, but you know, discussing, and I guess in a certain way, standing up for what they did, either individually or collectively, or the level of competition or the difficulty level. That's progress as far as I'm concerned. And so whether it's Eric or anybody else, and by the way, this is a tried and true type of thing. This is evergreen in all sports. previous generations will always say, ah, but, you know, it was so difficult back then and we had to go through this. And I'm, and again, we constantly try to put players in different eras and then judge them and try to figure out what they would look like. I'm of the opinion that if you're a good player or a great player in any era, if you get put in a different one, you'd figure it out. All right. So, you know, Messi playing back in the day, you know, back 50 years ago or something like that, he would still figure it out. All right. And someone that played back in the day, you know, a Pele or a Diego Maradona, with all of this, the stuff that they have going on today, I think they would be that much better. But when it comes to, you know, this particular question, so you mentioned we're leaving out goalkeepers. And I do think that there are plenty of goalkeepers along the way that not only rival, but surpass Matt Turner at this point. And whether it's a Tony Meola or a Friedel or a Keller, and the list goes on and on and on. And I think at a certain point, Matt Turner might become that, but I still think that they were better. A guy like Eddie Pope, I think, would start for this team. I think up top, given what we've said about the number nine position being wide open, I mean, then you can have your pick. So whether it's an Eric Winaldo, whether it is a Brian McBride, you know, whether it's, you know, let's see, I'm trying to think of some other people. I think a guy like Kobe Jones could be doing what Weah is doing out there on the right-hand side. I could definitely start in the back, not a problem. Let's see, who else would we have? I think, oh, all right. So, and I'm being a little flip here, but if I could only pick one, it's Tab Ramos. I've told you before, he's the best player that I played with. He was a man out of time. He was slumming it playing with us. Tab Ramos could walk into this team and not only start, okay, but with the lens of today and the focus and the microscope of today, we would be oohing and awing in a way that we don't when it comes to Gio Reyna or Christian Pulisic or anybody else. I'm sorry. That's how good Tab Ramos was, and that's how good he would be viewed through the lens of today if he were playing on this national team.
Yeah, as we've talked about, the perception young people have that the players today are much better, a lot of it has to do with the European club pedigree, but there wasn't the same level of acceptance back then. A Tab Ramos today would be like a 60 million pound player for a top European club, right?
Yeah, and he would have gone over at an early age, and the specialization would have happened, and all of those different pathways and those opportunities would be afforded to him and all of those players from the generation that they didn't necessarily have. Now, Tab did play overseas and had a wonderful career, but it would be on steroids if it was done in today's American soccer culture.
And by the way, Eric Winalda had a half season at Sauerbrücken when he first went over there in the 92-93 campaign. That still might be the best half season any American striker has had in a top European league. He was arguably the best striker in the Bundesliga for about a four-month period there, and then tailed off the second half of the year. Eric will tell you it had to do with the team, and he had some injuries and whatever the case was, but still, it was very impressive.
Plus, he takes free kicks. I mean, we've seen Eric can hit a corner better than Mr. Pulisic, that's for sure. So he already has a bunch of skills that I think would be viewed as very valuable to this team under Greg Berhalter right now. But there's no Eric Winaldo walking in that door right now.
And, you know, you joke about yourself. I think you were joking the way you said that. But I do look at center back right now as a position where the standard is not that high at the moment, at least compared to some of the other positions on the field. I look at guys like Chris Richards and Miles Robinson, Tim Ream, Cameron Carter-Vickers. It's not that much of a stretch to say that some of the center backs from your era could have...
Look, I will say this. When it comes to the way the game is played today and the demand for players to play a certain way under Greg Berhalter and pretty much all across the board, I am jealous. I would have loved to have been given the authority and the autonomy to play out of the back in the way that happens today on a consistent basis, because it is completely counter to what we were told back then in terms of that risk-reward type of situation right now. And I loved to, yes, kick people and do all that, but I also loved and recognized the value of keeping the ball. And in this modern game, and modern day where there is such a premium put on keeping the ball, I would have loved to have been a player in the modern game. What else, Mossy?
Next up, we have an Apple Podcast question. At KAC443 asks, with the addition of San Diego next season, would you be in favor of MLS restructuring to a divisional format and have scheduling like MLB where every team plays each other in the regular season rather than not getting every possible matchup currently? The reason why I'm asking this is that on Saturday, March 16th, was the first time Philadelphia played Austin, and this is Austin's fourth season in the league. That's not good for the fans.
Yes, I think I understand the question here in that you would, however it ends up looking, you would like teams to play each other that are in the same league. And the more that that happens, the better off it is. It is a little strange to me when teams don't play each other and you are still in the same league. Now, I get it. It becomes not something that's feasible because of the amount of teams that we have. And MLS is just continuing to get bigger and bigger and bigger. But I didn't realize that Philadelphia is playing Austin for the first time. And this is the fourth season in the league. That's, yeah, you're right. It is not good for fans. The marketing behind new teams, the excitement, whether it's in market or around the league when new teams come in, and you mentioned San Diego, but it applies to all these other teams. The payoff is that now you get to see them and they're coming to your location and you're going to their market, right? But if and when that doesn't happen, that separation and that division, it doesn't feel like a league unless each year, you know, because these are the teams in the leagues, these are the teams that we're going to play.
It's amazing how often the format has changed through the years. You go through the standings and divisions and different kinds of divisions and then no divisions now and just throw everybody in two different conferences. So yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be a stretch to change it again. They've done it so many times over the years.
And, you know, the people talk about the unbalance of a season. And so therefore it's a little wonky when you try to assess who the best team is. Well, you didn't play this team or you had to travel this much and all that kind of stuff. And if you had, you know, one table where everybody just plays everybody home and away, what that would look like. But it's because of the amount of teams, it's not something that's realistic going forward. So it is going to continue to be a work in progress, Mossy. It's never going to stop. They are going to continue to tweak it. I don't know if we have already seen the best version of it or if that best version is to come. But to your point over there, KAC443, don't be surprised if there are continued changes as we go forward. But I'm glad that Philadelphia gets to play Austin for the first time. We'll see what it looks like.
That is it.
All right, let's take another quick break. When we come back, it's the end of our show. We got a special one for the road. Don't go anywhere. Okay, welcome back. It's the end of our show. And at the end of each and every show, I give you my one for the road. And with yet another win over Mexico, we got to thinking about the history of great goals and memorable goals against Mexico. And, you know, we love lists over here. So we put together our list of the top five most memorable U.S. men's national team goals versus Mexico, according to me. And I'm sure you will disagree, or maybe you'll agree on some of these. All right, coming in at number five, the great Benny Failhaber versus Mexico in the 2007 Gold Cup. Just hits an absolute screamer. And this is back when Chicago actually was relevant when it comes to American soccer. But my, what a goal. Raises his hands to the heavens, gives a kiss. I mean, just, you could just watch this over and over again. He takes this one out of the air. Wonderful, wonderful volley. So that comes in at number five. Mossy, you got comments on this?
One note on Benny Failhaber. Him and I have lived very similar lives. He was also born in Rio de Janeiro.
That's right.
Also moved to Scarsdale, New York at an early age, which is where I moved to. I once interviewed him and brought that up to him. He couldn't care less.
All right. Well, let's see if you got anything on this guy here. The great Peter Vermes, a Rutgers guy. So I loved him even before he was starring for the national team in the and playing up top. A lot of people look at him as a defender, but they forget that in the 1990 World Cup, he was a striker for the U.S. And in the 1991 Gold Cup, Peter Vermes got the ball and he just dribbled through everybody and then just tipped this wonderful looping ball into the corner. And I know it's a little bit grainy, but you can still see the power and the skill and the finesse from the Jersey boy right there. So he comes in at number four.
That was in the 91 Gold Cup semis. The U.S. would then beat Honduras on penalties after a scoreless draw. A lot of people, including Eric Winalda, who we've already brought up on this pod, think this game is the original Dos Acero that started to turn the tide in the rivalry.
Yeah, I think that this is when that conversation about the pendulum, and obviously from a U.S. perspective, starting to swing over, yeah, started to happen. Now, there were still games and there were still losses along the way, but, you know, this, I agree with Eric in terms of how important this was, that kind of, this is the starting line, if you will. All right, number three, and it's fresh in our minds, and I think it will go on to be looked at as a, certainly a memorable goal, epic goal from Tyler Adams. After a long, long injury, he comes into this national team, and right at the end of the half, he hits a screamer from outside of the box, and this is not something that any of us knew he had in his locker, but this is a wonderful goal and kind of a walk-off for him, because at halftime, Greg Berhalter took him out, but this changed the dynamic of the game, and what a way to leave your mark in just 45 minutes of work.
Some people, including the great Matt Doyle, think this was a goalkeeping mistake by Ochoa. If you see the replay from behind, the shot wasn't as much in the corner as it might have looked, so it was poor positioning by Ochoa. He had a long time to react to it and really didn't.
Well, it could be poor positioning, but if you look at it, what Ochoa does is he takes one step to the left in order to create the opportunity to have a sight line to the ball. The problem is that in that exact moment is when the shot came, and so he had to react immediately. So the information that he got by putting that, getting that line of sight, was useless because his momentum had already gone to the left, and by the time he came to the right, to your point, it didn't go up or night or anything like that, but it was still moving. So that shows up at number three. Number two, Michael Bradley, the beautiful bald man down there in Mexico City, in the Azteca, a chip of just audacious proportion from, I mean, it's got to be what, 45 yards, 50 yards maybe, over Memo Ochoa. I mean, this was, yes, it was altitude aided, but it just stunned Azteca. And Bruce Arena loved it. I loved it. Everybody that was there loved it. And I think a lot of people talk about this to this day as to how important and memorable moment it was.
The important note here, Sean Sullivan was in attendance at this match at the Azteca. It's where he learned how to throw bags of urine at players. It's a skill he's brought back with him to the United States.
All right, before I give you my number one here, a couple of different also-rans that didn't make the top five, and then we'll give you our number one, right? So Landon Donovan in 2007 in Glendale. I know you wanted to mention that.
Can we look at that one?
Yeah, let's look at it. Ooh, here we go. All right.
Okay, what's interesting here, this was in a friendly in 2007 in Glendale, Arizona. What disqualifies it and why it ultimately did not belong on your list is that it would not have counted today, because once the ball hits the referee, play would have stopped. But what came after it? I mean, this is some Maradona against England stuff from Landon right
well,
here.
Well, I would disqualify it because it's a friendly, right? I mean, the circumstances of the actual games, I think, do matter in terms of being memorable.
I was going to ask you about that. It's not just the aesthetics of the goal. It's also the importance.
Yeah, I mean, we have titled it most memorable. And certainly, if it's just an incredible goal like it, and this one is, yeah, that's okay. A couple of other ones, the Pulisic man in the mirror shirt in the Nations League. I think that was wonderful. And not only for the goal, but the celebration and how iconic that was. Charlie Davies in Azteca scoring a goal. I'll never forget that because I was at the time working for ESPN, and I was I was down there with the great Bob Lee, and we were doing Sports Center hits from a roof across the way from Azteca, and Bob had never been to the Azteca, and it was like a bucket list for him. And so as soon as the game started, because we weren't actually televising it, we ran across the street, ran across the parking lot, went up into Azteca, and just as we got to this place, was basically just a place within the press box, Charlie Davies scored that goal. And just to see Bob Lee in that environment, and he had such an appreciation and respect and reverence for this incredibly historic venue, but also to see Charlie Davies score. So that was certainly one of them. And then from the other side, and we could go on, the Gio Dos Santos goal for Mexico at the Rose Bowl in the Gold Cup, I think that is certainly a memorable one from a Mexican standpoint.
Yeah, Bob Bradley's last game, Gold Cup final at the Rose Bowl. Also that Ambriz, Roberto Carlos-esque free kick, 93 Gold Cup final, probably the worst day of your life.
Oh my God, that thing was like Roberto Carlos-esque, went around us. Yeah, not a great wall that we set. All right, here we go. Number one, and it should come as no surprise, both in terms of the quality of it, but also in terms of being memorable. There is still no more important game and no more important win in American soccer history when it comes to the men's team than the United States beating Mexico 2-0 at the World Cup in 2002. And Landon Donovan's goal in 2002 at the World Cup is my number one goal when it comes to U.S.-Mexico goals. Here it is. Just feast your eyes upon it. And what it meant, what we were witnessing, and for those of us that weren't there like myself, we were up in the middle of the night watching these types of things, this was special. And this team was special. And Landon Donovan and company, this was Landon's kind of coming out party to the world. He was still very, very young, and Bruce Arena had faith in him, and he repaid that by, you know, scoring huge, huge goals. So let us know if you agree or disagree. Are you okay with that being number one?
Yeah, you could actually make a case for the other U.S. goal in that game, Brian McBride. That was a thing of beauty, too. Reyna down the right wing, yep. Low cross, the cutback, and then McBride strikes it. You know, you could argue the overall play of that one was...
But that was the first goal.
Correct.
Right? So this literally was the 2-0 goal.
And again, to get back to this point that younger generations don't appreciate how good some of these past U.S. players were, Landon was voted the best young player at that World Cup. Yeah. The U.S. had somebody that was voted the best young player at a World Cup. Landon was also the golden ball winner at an under-17 World Cup. So he did things that nobody in this generation has done yet that people don't give him enough credit
for. Not too shabby of a player. Very good player. But I'm glad that you pointed that out because, you know, we kick ourselves for what we aren't and what we haven't done. And sometimes it's important to remind people to, you know, we can pat ourselves on the back for an individual like Landon Donovan or how far we have come. Doesn't make me rest on our laurels by any stretch of the imagination. And hopefully that there are players coming, whether we've seen them already or we're going to see them, that are much better than Landon and everybody else there. I think Landon would be the first person to tell you that that's the goal. But we still have a wonderful history. Let us know if you agree or disagree with this top five out there. And if you do disagree, let us know where you think other ones should appear or a reordering of the five that we have. Mossy, anything before we go, my friend?
No, I'll just bring it back full circle to where we started. It was a fun night last night.
Yes.
Although we came up short in the end, it was great to spend time with you and Aaron and Sean downtown. And hopefully next time we come away with a trophy to show for it.
Well, I will say this when it comes to the State of the Union. You know, we started this this little this venture out in basically a closet. And it has grown by leaps and bounds through the incredible efforts of a lot of people, like I said. And, you know, whether it's Aaron or Sean, who were out with last night, and the list goes on, and Kat, and, you know, all the different people that we have had and had through the years that have built this thing into what it is. We are incredibly appreciative and thankful that we have so many people like that.
A couple of notes on last night. There is a true crime pod category. So we got to go over that with Kat afterwards and see if she agrees with the winners and who got nominated because she is the foremost expert on that kind of stuff. Secondly, I forgot to mention this at the top, but how about that Uber driver from Tajikistan that we had on our way to the event?
You want to tell the story quick before we go?
Yeah, the guy knew everything about soccer. We ended up talking to him for like 40 minutes on the drive. I debated with him Varatskelia's form for Napoli this season. He knew everything.
It was insane. So we get into the Uber, and I inform you, because it's on my thing, that he speaks both English and Russian. So immediately you throw out some Russian words there. And we ask him what he does when he's not driving. He goes, I'm a vlogger, and I put videos out 5 times a week. And it was just insane. Videos on what? Soccer? It was incredible. Serendipity or whatever it was. So we had a really, really good time. But we got our guide when it comes to Tajikistan and beyond when it comes to the soccer out there. All right, listen. Keep reviewing. Keep downloading. Keep rating. keep subscribing, doing all the different things that that you do. Awards are fine, okay, but we would much rather have your patronage. We would much rather have you tuning in, doing all the things that you do. We really appreciate that so many do, and so many have grown with us since that closet so many years ago. Have a wonderful weekend in terms of the soccer that you are watching and or playing. We will talk to you again next week. And until then, and as always, my friends, size the day.